pressure continues to be normal.
All right, the achiever pressure looks good.
Traveling up. Roger, Atlantic.
Water towers can fly!
Yes! Ego Delta nominal.
Water towers are FC off.
Yikes. You bet.
Okay.
We don't need any more of these.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the newest episode of NASA Spaceflight Live, the weekly news show where we wrap up the latest week of spaceflight news. Thank you all for tuning in on this Sunday to join both myself and our two good friends of mine to talk about a lot of different cool things that happened in spaceflight this week, from 31 Raptors firing at once, another Russian spacecraft is broken, Blue Origin might be going to Mars. We got a bunch of cool stuff to talk about this week, and we're going to dive in and also take a lot of your questions. I see a bunch of 5x5s in chat, which is letting me know that you can all hear me and see us, which is great. And like I said, if you want to get involved in today's discussion, it's a interactive show. Please tag us at NASA Spaceflight and chat. I'm going to be bringing those in throughout the course of the show. And no matter what we're talking about, we'll try to bring in some questions to get you all involved in the discussion as well. I should introduce the two friends that are here with me on this side. We have Mr. Chris Gibhart, Assistant Managing Editor here at NASA Spaceflight. Chris, how are you doing today?
I am doing just fine and dandy myself. Thomas, how about you?
Oh, I'm doing well. Long time no talk, Chris. I think the three of us have been pretty busy the last 14 hours or so. Sawyer Rosenstein on my other side here, another contributor here at NASA Spaceflight. Sawyer, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm glad I'm still awake after last night because there's still so much to talk about today. It's exciting, and let's get into it.
Yeah, it's been a busy week. Also, a big shout out to Michael Baylor behind the scenes operating today's show. And a thank you to all the moderators in chat and stuff like that that are helping make this show possible. Let's dive into some spaceflight news. And of course, we're all hinting at the launch that happened this morning. That was the second of two SpaceX launches this week. So let's start by recapping those. First off, the Amazonas Nexus mission. Sawyer, you wrote our launch article for that mission. What's going on with the Amazonas Nexus commsat that was launched by SpaceX this week?
I did indeed. Yes, that successfully lifted off 8:32 p.m. Eastern time this past Monday. It was a beautiful, gorgeous, clear night for a launch as well. The spacecraft bringing up, as you mentioned, Amazonas Nexus, which is part of the Amazonas sort of group of satellites that are up there right now operated by Hispasat. This one is actually replacing an older one in their fleet. And the goal of these satellites is to help provide high throughput data to places that might not always get it. So while it covers all the Americas, it also covers sea assets in the Atlantic Ocean, airplanes, as well as Greenland, which doesn't get a lot of love, but is finally getting some with this satellite as well.
Yeah, and a rare non-Starlink mission too. SpaceX, obviously, a lot of their launch cadence comprising of the Starlink constellation, but this is a communications satellite for an external customer, and I think we're expecting a few more of those this year. In fact, the next one from here at the Cape will be one for Inmarsat, another commsat name people may have heard of. So good to change up what exactly is launching from the Cape here and there. Another successfully landed booster, that was booster 1073, making its sixth flight, and a successful recovered fairing halves from that mission as well. So reusability helping to support that launch cadence as well. Chris, you were on...
Fun fact of the reusability, the boat that was out there recovering all of the fairings actually came back with four fairing halves instead of two, as it was just stayed stationed out there after a previous mission where it captured the fairings and brought these back as well.
Yeah, exactly. The other mission that happened this week, the three of us were on early this morning for our live launch coverage, Starlink Group 5-4. Chris G, you want to overview that mission and the record that it broke?
Oh, yes, because it was a record for a couple of different reasons. But the big one that you are referring to is the pad turnaround record. SpaceX beat their previous record for turning around pad 40 at the Cape Canaveral Space Force Station by just about 6 hours. The previous record was 5 days, 9 hours, 28 minutes. And SpaceX broke it with this liftoff at 5 days, 3 hours, and 38 minutes after Amazonas Nexus. So a good rapid cadence coming there from pad 40, and also seeing the recovery assets in work as well. This particular mission lofted 55 Starlink satellites into orbit on booster 1062-12, which did successfully level up to number 13 when it landed on a shortfall of gravitas a few minutes after its liftoff.
I like leveled up. I like that.
Yeah,
exactly, right? And the other record that was on this particular mission, according to SpaceX, one of the fairing halves was flying for the eighth time, and that would be a record as well. So some good records all around with that liftoff last night.
Yeah, we don't always get a lot of insight into the fairing reuse. A lot of times, the only time we know which, you know, how many times the fairing has flown is when they announce it sometimes on the official webcast. There's not big obvious serial numbers for us to track. The boosters are much more easy to keep track of. But eight flights for a fairing is in fact a record. So there's a new fleet leader, I suppose, in the fairing fleet, in addition to the fleet leaders that we all know from the booster fleet. And again, this goes into the pad turnaround and the reusability, I think, are both big factors in launch cadence. SpaceX is aiming for new records as far as launches within a calendar year. I wrote up a whole article on NASAspaceflight.com if you want to read up more about this. But the overall premise is last year they launched 61 missions. That is more flights. It was 60 Falcon 9s and one Falcon Heavy. 60 Falcon 9s was more than any rocket type in a single calendar year in the history of spaceflight. And so 61 missions for the company overall is a huge accomplishment. They're aiming to beat that again this year. They're already on pace to launch 80 something missions this year if the current pace continues. And they're aiming for as many as 100 flights either this year or maybe next year. Starship coming online is going to help that equation too. But things like turning pads around quickly, drone ships being turned around quickly, and you know, some creative manifest management where you can intersperse the RTLS missions with drone ship missions too. And then reused booster and fairing availability. Those are the things that are going to enable higher launch cadence, not just in support of the Starlink missions, but customer missions as well. So that's something that's a storyline to keep an eye on definitely for the end of the year, I would say.
Yeah, and it's SpaceX's own record to break at this point. I think it's just a little worth noting that the previous record was set in 1979 with the Soyuz U rocket at 47 flights. So it not only broke it, it shattered it. When the record finally fell. Yeah.
Yeah. And Soyuz U, you know, Soyuz has a million different variants and Soyuz U is not one that's flying anymore. But the Soyuz flight rate back then was something to behold. And now Falcon has, like you said, shattered that record. We have one question to bring in. I guess this isn't a question, but something else that we could mention. This is, I don't know if it's technically a record, but Khalid wants us to point out that SpaceX has landed a Falcon 9 for 97 consecutive times without a failure now with this morning's landing. And that is the same number of perfectly successful Atlas V missions. Atlas V has flown 97 missions, all of which were declared a success by their customers. I know there's the one NRO mission. I agree with ULA on that one. NRO says it's good, it's good. Point being, 97 successful Atlas V missions. Falcon 9 has now landed that many times consecutively, not even just talking about launches. So that's something to just point out. It's an interesting context for the way the industry is moving, I think.
That is too. And just for folks, because Thomas, you mentioned the caveat to the Atlas, but I agree with you and I agree with ULA. If the customer declares it a success, it's a success. Don't grumble, because that applies to Falcon 9 as well, with one of its early flights that got the primary payload to orbit, but the secondary payload didn't. Mission was still declared a success because Dragon got to orbit.
Right, yeah. So that rule being applied across the board, not trying to be unfair or anything. But yeah, there we go. So cool things to keep an eye on. I'm sure we're going to talk more about these kind of storylines later down the year as well, especially as we get towards the end and see how many launches will SpaceX rack up, I should say. Really quick, City became a Capcom member, so a huge thank you to those who joined the membership program. If you want those extra perks at Capcom, you get access to the Discord, where you get to see all of us be terrible at Kerbal Space Program, among other things, and just hang out with us, and another place to discuss spaceflight news. Check that out. You also get emojis in chat and all this other stuff, behind the scenes photos and things, so definitely recommend checking that out. Huge thank you to anyone who sent support our way over the course of the stream. Still think we're waiting on the first merch buy. Remember, if you buy merch and send in a message, it'll pop up on the top right of the screen, and whoever happens to be up there, I think it's Sawyer right now, yep, there we go. If you want to check out the shop, thank you, Michael, you can cover up Sawyer's face with a merch message, and that's always fun. So in case
it's
those
it's our metric of how much you love us,
yeah.
Or we'll go with that.
But in the meantime, let's move on to our next news story, and I'm going to hand this off to Chris Gebhardt, because he spent some time out at the Tern Basin at the Kennedy Space Center this week, where the NASA teams were working on some Orion recovery training in support of the Artemis program. Christy, what was that all about?
Yes, indeed they were. So with Artemis 1 successfully in the books being the uncrewed test flight of Orion around the moon, next up is Artemis 2, which will include four astronauts inside of Orion. And just like these Navy divers and naval teams needed to do for Starliner ahead of its first crew flight, which is coming up here in a couple of months, and just like they had to do ahead of the first Dragon crew missions and continue to do for training purposes with the Dragons and Starliners as well, they have to figure out and practice how to get crew members out of Orion when it splashes down in the Pacific. They have actually been, so that video that you were just watching was from one day of training when they were actually doing the training of how to get a compromised crew member out of Orion, and compromised in this case meaning that they are injured in some way and they do not have full mobility, and you need to have some extra care and precaution to get them out of the capsule. They were training how to get them out in that particular scenario, training how to get the collars around Orion once it's in the water, and the front porch, as they call it as well, which is the big inflatable raft that they actually, that you saw them carrying people out onto. What's absolutely fascinating about this, they practice in the Tern Basin first, so it's calmer, stable conditions where they can actually work through their processes. And especially, this is the first time they're doing this with Orion, so it's not just about massive efficiency here. It's about getting used to how Orion is different from Starliner, how Orion is different from Dragon, because the same collar, the same front porch, the same rafts that they use that you're seeing in these photographs here for Orion are the exact same ones that are used for Dragon and Starliner as well. So they just attach at different places. And then obviously with the different sizes of the capsules, there's some difference in how they actually respond once you're in the water. So that's a lot of what they were doing here today as well. And it was a fascinating question. It was one that actually came up while we were there on site, because you're watching them bring a crew member out on a stretcher.
Right.
And someone asked the logical question, how do you make sure you don't accidentally drop the stretcher with the person strapped onto it? Well, NASA is NASA. They have thought through this. The Navy has thought through this. The Navy has a lot of experience rescuing people in different types of conditions and sea states and all of that. So basically, there are enough humans there where four people always have a grip on it, so you never actually lose grip on that. But also, the spacesuits provide buoyancy. So if you ever were to actually lose grip in an emergency situation with someone on a stretcher, they would float. And they would still be completely, they would likely have their helmet down in a case like that as well for that additional type of protection. So it is an answer that they have thought through.
Interesting. They also have, there aren't there also divers in the water too for various contingencies and support during these operations?
That's exactly right as well. And some of the divers were there as well. So there's always someone underneath to assist and provide that situational awareness for what they are seeing from the water themselves.
Right. Gotcha. Let me see if I got some questions coming in. We do have some Artemis questions. And the first one comes from Wright, who asks, what kind of orbit are we expecting for the Artemis 2 mission, which is, of course, the next Orion flight?
Interestingly, we are not expecting an orbit at all, really. The main goal
technically,
of this one,
yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, maybe once or twice around ahead of the TLI burn, which would be translunar injection. But the main goal for Artemis 2 is to kind of do a little bit of a figure eight in a way and swing past the moon and do a flyby around it before returning back to Earth.
Yeah, it's what's known in the industry as a free return trajectory.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Where no, if you lose all propulsion or something, the spacecraft will naturally return to Earth on its own just due to gravity and things. That's Artemis 1 spent a lot of time in lunar orbit because there's no crew on board, so you can take all the time you wanted to check out various spacecraft systems and things. For the crewed test flight, if you're not going to do a landing, you're not going to dock to the gateway station or anything like that, there's no reason to spend a whole lot of time. The main point of the mission is to test life support systems and things, which you can just do over the week or so that that trajectory ends up being. And so it makes a lot more sense to make it a shorter flight on Artemis 2. And then going forward, obviously, Artemis 3 and beyond are landing missions, so they'll have surface excursions and things like that.
And exactly what you were just saying there too, Thomas, about, you know, just go and get it done, right, and come back, don't prolong it, was originally the plan for Dragon's Demo 2 flight. It is the plan for Starliner's flight, brief 1 week test flights with the crew. Mm-hmm. Dragon's, which is the one we're all very familiar with because it's already happened, just ended up becoming longer because of the crew rotation needs on the space station, but was not supposed to be a multi-month mission to begin with.
Yeah, okay, gotcha. Other question here. This is, we're talking about timelines for Artemis 2. I have two questions that I'll tie into one. One of them is, what's the next timeline for the next Artemis launch? But also tying into that, do we have an update on when the crew of Artemis 2 is going to be announced?
Oh, both very good questions. To the crew one, no, we do not know the exact day that the crew will be announced yet. NASA, all NASA has said is that after the successful completion of Artemis 1, we would get the crew announcements within a few months. Arguably, we're 3 months like, out from so the like liftoff. I would sort of put my money on before the midway point of the year, because dedicated training is going to need to start happening across various centers. And remember, too, it's not just NASA that's involved with this. It's Canada as well. We know that one of the astronauts will be one of the Canadian astronauts
on
board.
We even kind of know which Canadian astronaut, like almost certainly.
Yes, but here's where I am never going to say that name, because everyone who makes crew predictions verbally is usually always wrong.
That's
because
true.
there is so much that goes into it, and logic does not usually play, and logic plays into it, but in ways that the public doesn't necessarily think about, right? Because they're looking at not just, hey, who has the skill sets for this mission, but hey, how do these personalities work together? Who's the most efficient crew? Who's got more test fighter experience? Because this is a test mission versus maybe putting a scientist on board. All of these things factor into it. And then also, it's just at the discretion of the chief of the astronaut office.
Yes.
So just, yeah, I'm going to refrain from giving the name. But yes, we're fairly certain we know the Canadian, but I'm going to refrain from giving the name. Yeah.
Hopefully we find out officially soon.
I was going to say, I also believe we just got a new head of the astronaut office as well recently. So
we did, yes.
Yeah. And the previous head of the astronaut office did not retire. They stepped down to resume active astronaut status, which could also be a hint, but I'm going to end my speculation for the same reason Chris did. I don't want to jinx anything or be wrong, and because it's very hard to predict these things from the outside looking in. Other quick questions that I know we got three huge news stories that I want to jump into after this, but we're getting some good Artemis questions, so I'll try to speed run these. A really quick one I can take from James Atkinson, wondering if there will be a full duration static fire test of Artemis 2. No, that was exclusively an Artemis 1 thing. All the engines have been individually tested and things like that, but no full duration static fire. They might go through another wet dress rehearsal before launch, Chris? Is that right?
Maybe, but if they did, it would just be to verify any changes that they have made to the ground side of the system after Artemis 1. There's no requirement to do a wet dress rehearsal for Artemis 2.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so
essentially, the only kind of static fire we'll expect is the testing that they do down at Stennis for the main engines, and also probably some of the booster testing they do out in Colorado as well.
Yeah. We're getting a lot of good Artemis questions, so speed running this really quick. Robbie Rob asking, why are they training for water landings with Starliner? Doesn't it only land on land? Nominally, yes, but this was off-nominal training, and there is contingencies, especially a pad abort scenario or an in-flight abort scenario. Starliner can splash down safely still, and so this is, for training purposes, you cover all your bases.
And in fact, if they do not do the orbital insertion maneuver, they are coming down in the water as well. Yep.
Yes. And then one last question from Jeremy. Who do you think will be the first to land the next craft on the moon, NASA or SpaceX? Trick question. The answer is both. I'm assuming you're talking about a crewed spacecraft, because the Artemis landings will be a SpaceX vehicle with NASA crew, in partnership with NASA, NASA crew on board, stuff like that. So technically, the answer is both. But we're going to move right on, because we've got a whole lot of good Artemis questions, and some of these tie in with Starship discussion that we'll get to in a bit. But I want to move on to a different reusable rocket program that got a very interesting launch contract this week. NASA has selected Blue Origin and their New Glenn rocket to launch the Escapade mission to Mars. You see a render of it here. These are two spacecraft based on the Photon satellite bus that Rocket Lab has designed and developed.
And those two spacecraft are going to hitch a ride on a New Glenn rocket as early as late 2024, headed to the Red Planet. This pair of spacecraft are going to study Mars' magnetosphere. And of course, this contract got a lot of interest because New Glenn has not made an orbital debut yet. A lot of times for specific launch contracts, vehicles have to fly once or twice before they're eligible for certain contracts, especially missions to Mars. You would think there needs to be a track record. Chris, you want to tell us about what's up with this launch contract and why it's not quite the same as like the Mars rovers that we've launched before?
Yeah. So basically NASA and the international community, they have different classes of missions. So like the big rover missions like Curiosity and Perseverance that we're hearing a lot about are the big flagship science missions from NASA. And then they also have other categories, including this category of smallsat explorers, right? And utilizing and leveraging the low cost for high return scientific value that these small satellites can do. Because if you're only interested in studying Mars's magnetosphere, you don't need a big Mars reconnaissance orbiter. You don't need a MAVEN. You don't need a MOM Mars orbiter mission. That's India's. You don't need Alamal from the United Arab Emirates. You just need something a little bit bigger than a CubeSat with large enough solar arrays to power an instrument or two. And this is where you can really leverage the cheapness of these small sats. And because of that, NASA is also willing to take a little more risk in the launch vehicle that these get assigned to. And by that, I don't mean a slight to Blue Origin. I mean, this is the way they always work. And you can look at Vulcan, you can look at Falcon 9 and others as well in this same category. One of the ways you certify rockets for the much larger and more important missions is by having them do these smaller class exploratory missions first. And that's part of what this is. And that's part of why this was very exciting to see for Blue Origin, because it not only is starting to speak to the confidence of the launch industry that New Glenn will be ready sometime soon. You can see that this launch contract is technically for 2024. And we all know there's a ticking clock with a Mars window because they're only open for about 3 weeks every 26 months with the rocket technology we have now. So you're seeing pieces start to come together that indicate that 2023 might be an exciting test year for Blue Origin for some of the New Glenn components. And of course, one of the tests will also be the BE-4 engine's introduction on Vulcan, which is the rocket that will fly that particular engine first. But overall, really exciting for Blue Origin here.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you touched on some really important things. New Glenn is not the first vehicle to undergo this process. Falcon 9 was awarded contracts to resupply the International Space Station before it existed. And so this is very common, actually, to onboard new launchers, give them relatively lower risk missions. It's interesting that they've done this. And so we have some questions coming in about this, and the first one from James Atkinson asks, did New Glenn win this contract to support diversity of launch providers, or is New Glenn actually cheaper than SpaceX for these small sat launches? So things to consider here. This will likely not be a rideshare payload. I'll add a caveat to that. It's very hard to find rideshare payloads going to Mars. There aren't many missions that go that far. But these small satellites are probably also not taking the full payload capacity of New Glenn to Mars, right? Some healthy payload margin there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And again, that's part of the benefits, I think, of it being a test.
Chris, I think you might be muted. Make sure you check that really quick.
Oh, there we are.
I was, since the significant other walked by. a lot of payload margin is going to remain for a vehicle of that size throwing something that small out to Mars. The only other caveat I might give to a potential rideshare is if the initial parking orbit was just right for a satellite that needed to get to a 28.6 degree Leo-esque inclination and you could jettison it before you did the trans-Mars injection burn, right? You could get something, but I'm with you on that one. Most likely it's going to be dedicated, or Blue Origin might throw in a surprise to test some of their own equipment. This would be a potential good way to have a customer pay for the launch that injects a test article of yours out into the solar system.
Right, exactly. And I want to touch on that because we actually know, and this is via Jeff Faust of Space News, that the launch contract value for this task order is only $20 million. So let's set aside a couple things that we should debunk right now. No, a New Glenn launch does not cost $20 million. So this is, which could be two things. It could mean it's basically a test flight that Blue Origin is willing to operate with, you know, this contract will help offset the cost, but it's not going to cover the cost of operating the launch or something like that. That's not uncommon early on in launch vehicle careers either. Or, like we've touched on, could be a rideshare of some kind, either drop something off in LEO before the Transmars injection burn, or New Glenn internal payloads or something like that. So there are options for them to adjust for that. But it also gives you an idea of how these contracting structures work. And this program is called VADER, the Venture Class Acquisition of Dedicated and Rideshare Missions. And so these low risk, low cost missions can be awarded to higher risk, not because of the vehicle, but just because it hasn't flown yet. Launch providers and things like that.
I need to explain my laugh, because my laugh was at the fact that VADER is the acronym for this and was also the acronym for the Orion test that were doing in the water as well. So that's why I laughed. Acronyms at NASA do have different meanings.
Yeah.
But I was going to say that it's really interesting with this, in that they're basically doing everything they can to cut costs, in that you're talking the pre-built rocket lab base, basically, with Photon. So everything you can to kind of make it cheap, so that in the event something happens, you're not losing as much. But if it works, you're gaining a lot of science. And I think that's just the main point of these type of contracts, is give experience to these new customers in terms of satellites, give experience to the new rockets from all the different launch providers. And hey, if it goes, you get a lot back in science return as well.
Yeah, and part of the reason that these missions are considered low cost and low risk is because, ideally, let's say something goes wrong with the launch one way or the other, NASA can go back to Rocket Lab and say, hey, can you build two more of those? We'll try it again. Like, the point of the cost structure is that you could, in theory, repeat the mission if something goes wrong.
Less than how we've had to repeat the cost of building stuff before when missions went wrong. Yeah,
exactly. So that's the rationale behind that. We got some more questions. Also, we got gifted a red team membership from Chris Watt. So Chris, thank you so much for your generosity and your support there. JTTV has a question. What about Amazon buying all of the blue flights? Where does this NASA flight now fit in? So a lot of New Glenn's upcoming manifest is for the Amazon Kuiper constellation, which is basically a competitor to Starlink, a Starlink internet constellation. Is it correct to say that they've bought all of Blue's flights, or is that, you know, a large part of the manifest? You know, Chris, how would you characterize New Glenn's manifest and how this flight fits in?
Large part of the manifest. You should think of the Kuiper constellation as you do the Starlink constellation, if that helps. It's going to be a large part of their manifest, large part of Arianespace's and ULA's manifest in the coming few years as well. But it's not going to be all of them. And remember too that New Glenn's first stage, like Falcon's first stage, are designed to be recovered and reused multiple times, which will help with that overall flight rate as well, and help with the manifesting options of how they sequence the Kuiper constellation and the dates that we often make a. Okay, because Starlink is sort of rolling along very nicely in its deployment plan, we often forget to step back and mention the FCC has dates by which percentages that the constellations have to be finished by. This is why Amazon went out and bought Arianespace and ULA and Blue Origin rockets to ensure they were meeting those contractual deadlines. So we talk about them as internal missions. They are still important because they're trying to hit deadlines, but the booster reusability is going to be what helps Blue Origin sequence all of those between the customer missions as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And New Glenn is also targeting a lower flight rate than some of those other launch vehicles too. I mean, it's a reusable rocket. The idea is to operate a fleet of these vehicles, which will help enable that. But they're not aiming for launching once or twice a week, at least not initially. So that's something to keep in mind in that conversation as well. Motispace Industries gifted a red team membership as well. So Motispace, appreciate the support there as always. We have a good question here from Ross, who says, how likely do you think it is that New Glenn will be ready to launch an interplanetary mission in time for the 2024 Mars transfer window? So for some context, and I'll open this up for discussion, the transfer window opens near the end of 2024. The following window is near the end of 2026. And if spacecraft or launch vehicle readiness were to come up as an issue for this mission, they could, of course, target the next window. But to the spirit of the question, Sawyer, you go first. What are you thinking about New Glenn's progress towards flight and how they could be prepared to meet this transfer window?
Actually, a really good question. I mean, we've seen some major progress. The fact that we now have BE-4s that are actually built and will be tested hopefully later this year on Vulcan, in flight at least. And then we've seen them doing fairing recovery practice, seen a lot of equipment out even by the Tern Basin, that they were loading some stuff a few weeks ago. So they're kicking it into overdrive. So I think it's possible. And that's assuming, though, that every test milestone goes exactly as planned. And that's always sure. The tricky part with a new vehicle is that it doesn't always go as planned. So I think it's going to be close. I think they might be able to do it. But if not the 2026 window, I would say with certainty they could hit.
Sure. Yeah, I would say 26 is a very reasonable target. Chris, would you agree for that as New Glenn readiness for a low cost, low risk mission like this?
Yeah, and I would also say that I wouldn't necessarily expect this mission to necessarily hold its place in the manifest. If the manifest starts to slip because first flight slips, this is one of those missions that will likely just remain a target in 2024, regardless, until either the entire system can't do it or the payloads end up not being able to make the launch window, which sometimes happens. Sometimes it's not the rocket's fault that it misses a window, that sometimes it's the mission's.
Yeah. And on a similar note, this is kind of Blue Origin and New Glenn overall. Felix wants to know our thoughts about, is Blue Origin moving as slowly as sometimes it seems? Or is it more of a factor of SpaceX just moves abnormally fast and we're making a weird comparison? Is it because we don't have a whole lot of insight? You know, New Glenn isn't being built in tents near the side of the road that most people can take a look into. You know, they have a manufacturing complex that's more or less behind closed doors. So thoughts on Blue Origin's overall progress, and especially towards New Glenn specifically, Chris?
Yeah. So one, I'll answer the second part of that first. Yes, SpaceX does move abnormally fast for the industry as a whole. So using them as the benchmark is not necessarily the average, right, that the whole industry has. Now, that said, New Glenn was originally unveiled to the public in September 2016, but design work on the vehicle has been ongoing for about 11 years. So it's the answer to both of your questions is yes, it is moving somewhat slowly especially for the commercial realm. Right. Vulcan did not take this long either, and it's using the same engines. But this has taken, I mean, this is honestly, I mean, SLS took from 2011 to 2022, and New Glenn is 2012, and we're in 2023. So if it doesn't launch this year, it will actually have taken it more calendar years than SLS to get off the ground.
Interesting. And of course, there are caveats to that too, right? I mean, resources and things that go into development especially in the first couple of years of development are not always the same across different programs, but a worthwhile.
I think at one point it was a three-stage rocket at one point,
yeah,
two,
or like one that had two options.
Yeah.
Fairing looked weird at one point. I don't know if anyone remembers like the fairing that originally looked like. I don't know why they started that. It looks way better now.
That's, by the way, going back to what you were saying there, Chris, what's interesting is that yes, Vulcan is moving faster, but Vulcan is also using a lot of what they learned from Atlas and Delta, whereas Blue Origin here, the only vehicle they currently have flying is New Shepard, which again on hold at the moment, but that's nowhere near what you're talking about for an orbital class rocket. So it's kind of it's almost like trying to basically develop Falcon 1 and Falcon 9 again.
Right. And we should make clear too that while we say this year for the initial flight, the last update that we had a year ago from Blue Origin was quarter four of 2023. For New Glenn's first flight. So don't want to set an expectation that we'll be seeing it in summer. We might see it in summer, but it's not launching in summer.
Right, yeah. And of course, if we apply Berger's Law, as our friend Eric Berger likes to coin, Q4 usually means actually the next year, but yes, we'll have to wait and see for an official update as far
however,
as
it didn't
goes.
For SLS.
That's true. It is not a law, it's a theory, clearly. Here's a great question from the Visualist, who says, what kind of permits does a flight to Mars require? So this is probably along the lines of, you know, planetary protection and things like that. So Chris, what kind of process, and of course these are NASA payloads, so what kind of work are they going to be doing?
Yeah, so and therein lies the caveat. It's a NASA mission. So there, NASA is the government. So the government doesn't license the mission itself, right? Because it's a NASA flight as this. So for this launch, the way the commercial entities would interact with this is to license the actual commercial launch of the New Glenn for the NASA mission. If when private companies like Rocket Lab start sending their spacecraft out into the solar system, this is another interesting part, because now technically the FCC has to be involved in the licensing of that communication, but unless you're going to build your own deep space network, you've got to use government assets to do it. And the government therefore has its list of, okay, here's how much it costs to use the dish for this much time and for this particular bandwidth. So it is an interesting question. In terms of permits, the honest answer to this is it doesn't matter the company. It's the nation that licenses the launch is the nation responsible for the permitting, the communication, and everything that happens. So it's a really good question, because those same questions are going to be applied to commercial lunar colonization and commercial Mars endeavors as well. So yeah, the permits will indeed be a thing, but exactly what they are, haven't crossed that yet.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting development to keep track of, not just with this mission, which is more or less akin to missions that I've already launched, but when companies start launching completely internal missions with no government customers on board, which could happen this decade for all we know, it'll be interesting to see how that gets handled. One more question on the Blue Origin topic I think we got here. Lucas has to ask, have we heard any updates on Project Jarvis? So the context for this is Jarvis was a code name given to like a rapid development program within Blue Origin to develop a new upper stage for the New Glenn system, a reusable upper stage, basically transition New Glenn from a partially reusable design to a fully reusable design. And this has likely come up later as a like evolution of the New Glenn launch system down the road after the mission, after the vehicle debuts. This will not, as far as we know, not be used for this Mars mission or anything, but it's definitely something that could come up in future, either Mars missions or maybe moon missions and things like that. Sawyer, have we heard anything about New Glenn evolutions right now?
I haven't seen anything recently on it. Everything has basically kind of just been sort of the speculation of where we'll end up going with that Project Jarvis. But from what I've seen, it's still kind of a mystery.
Yeah, I don't think we've even heard anything super. Has Blue Origin even like officially acknowledged that program?
Not to my knowledge, actually. He has talked. Bezos has talked somewhat about new management structure for Jarvis. So I guess yes, technically they have admitted that Project Jarvis exists.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in terms of like, there was no budget, there was no timeline, there was nothing has actually been publicly released. And the last we heard was September and August of 2021.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we haven't seen any something. This was a couple of years ago where this project kind of came to be, and it's probably best classed as, you know, super early Starship prototyping. Like, they literally had a very small team in the advanced development program that were given some sort of, hey, go do this, see how this might work. Like, pure prototyping. This isn't like, all right, we're on a path to flight readiness yet. This was purely a experimental kind of exploratory kind of thing that we'll likely see come back in a couple of years as a, okay, here's the actual formal design that we're going to build and fly as a future evolution of the vehicle. So it's not weird that we haven't really heard much in the last year or so, because we'll expect to hear more later down the line. All right, I think that's all the big Blue Origin questions we can get to. We've got two other big news stories that I want to get into. So before we move into that, Cynthia, thank you for becoming a Capcom member. Greatly appreciate that amount of support. And we have a whole bunch of gifted Red Team memberships. Stefan gifted a membership, so Stefan, thank you. Dougal gifted 5 Red Team memberships. And then we've got Jim Cavett and Alan both gifting a Red Team membership as well. So everyone who is sending support our way, greatly, greatly appreciate all of the support. And if you received a membership from any of those donations, definitely thank them in chat for their generosity. We greatly appreciate that. Starship 24 also offered a bit of super chat support. So Ship 24, appreciated. Hope your pre-flight preps are going well. We're going to get to that in 1 second, but one more news story before we get to Starship, and I know we'll get into some questions there as well. But on the International Space Station, never a dull moment these days. So recently, the Progress MS-22 mission successfully launched from Baikonur and docked to the International Space Station. That was just the other morning. And everything was going well with that mission. And as far as we know, everything is still going well on board. However, its brother, Progress MS-21, which has been docked on the station for several months now, another uncrewed cargo vehicle, sprung a leak in its coolant loop. And if that sounds familiar, it's because the Soyuz MS-22 spacecraft, which is the crewed variant of that vehicle, also had a leak in its coolant loop just a couple months ago, back in December. So this is the second time in recent history that this kind of family of vehicles has encountered this issue. And it's interesting because the original issue on the Soyuz vehicle was accredited to a micrometeorite strike. And that was based on a couple different factors. The Roscosmos and NASA jointly actually came out and both concurred publicly on the results of this investigation. And it came down to where on the spacecraft the leak actually developed. It wasn't in the direction that the station orbits. And so it doesn't make sense for it to be like orbital debris because the station's moving in the wrong direction. Based on that, the most likely outcome was micrometeorite strike. So a deep speed, small pebble or rock, basically, that impacted the vehicle. But now the exact same system has a very similar leak twice in a row. And the odds of two micrometeorite strikes hitting the same system on the same vehicles, basically the same vehicles, is not zero. But it's offering some interesting conversations to now be had. Chris, I'm going to open it up with you. What are you thinking about this?
Yeah, so first I want to back up to the micrometeorite strike, right? As rare as that would have been, totally possible, a statistical possibility, and one of the things that is higher on the risk matrix, right, for these types of flights. It's sort of lumped in with that MMOD, micrometeorite orbiting debris is what we call it. So one hit happening is sort of like a wow. I mean, sucky luck, but thank God it hit a coolant loop. Right. And nothing else. And you know, the solar arrays on the ISS have small little holes. The ISS has little dings on it, on its shielding, far less than we had actually anticipated, which tells us a little bit more about the percentage chances of these hits happening, but totally possible. But yeah, the two spacecraft within 2 months that use very similar designs, because Progress and Soyuz are very similar to one another. They use the same basic designs, just the modules on Progress don't actually separate away from each other like they do on Soyuz, because Progresses don't survive atmospheric reentry. But yeah, this is going to raise questions, and it has to raise questions, because the statistical probability of that happening twice in a row in a couple of months are either small, or the debris threat environment in orbit is becoming way more than we are aware of, and we're just not seeing that reality playing out on other spacecraft. Right, we're not seeing Dragons
right.
being hit, we're not seeing Cygnuses being hit, we're not seeing giant holes in the solar arrays. So this does raise questions, and to be, I mean, I know Russia will not like this, I know Roscosmos will not like this, but to be completely fair, this is part of a potential string of issues now, right? We were willing to give them one on micrometeoroid, but two, this starts going back to the defects where they had drilled a hole in the pressure vessel of the orbital module of a Soyuz a few years ago and tried to blame it on a NASA astronaut. But there was clear evidence that it was attempted to be fixed on the ground before liftoff. That was the one where they were literally sawing off the insulation on the outside of the Soyuz at one point. You know, we have had quality control issues, and it is also, to be fair, completely impossible to overlook the strapped nature of the overall Russian economy right now with what they chose to do in Ukraine. So there are just a lot of things that would raise questions, and I would very much imagine that one of the first questions NASA officials began to ask is, so that coolant system that's exactly the same on Soyuz MS-23 that's about to launch on the emergency rescue flight to replace Soyuz MS-22, how do we know 5 months from now it's not going to spring a leak? Because it was about five months and Soyuz MS-22 sprung a leak, about 5 months and Progress MS-21 sprung a leak.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, lots of questions here.
And there are definite explanations, and Sawyer, I want to get your voice in on this too. I want to offer that there are more complicated answers than either they got really unlucky with two micrometeor strikes, or Russia is somehow sabotaging the ISS. Like, there's a lot of different explanations in between those two explanations, okay? One potentially is, what if, like Chris said, the debris environment, including micrometeorites or actual artificial debris in low Earth orbit, that environment would probably understandably be becoming more hostile. The fact is that we launch things more often these days across the world. The United States, probably the largest player in that. And is it a factor of, okay, this particular part of Progress is apparently particularly susceptible to suffering from a strike, whereas other vehicles and designs are withstanding more hits or something like that. That's a plausible explanation that has, you know, and so that's a combination of, okay, we need to really be assessing this environment, but also this part of Progress and Soyuz needs to be reinforced or something. You know, there are different solutions there. There's also several kind of explanations or storylines that would explain Russian vehicles having issues in the last couple months to years. And all of this is going to be a very nuanced conversation, because the question of what should international cooperation look like in spaceflight has been raised in the last couple of years, not just with Russia, but also with China, as well as the, you know, American and European and Canadian and the more typically aligned space programs that have cooperated for years and years. Those are questions that are going to be raised, and these kind of events definitely play a part in that. Sawyer, would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, micrometeorite damage is not unheard of. If you look at the cupola windows, there are still little pings and dings in it from small orbital debris or small things that have been dropped, or what, small micrometeorites, whatever the case may be. So it's not unheard of. The ISS has been hit before and will continue to be hit. Right. But it is definitely interesting of the fact that we're talking the same system here. And what will also be very interesting to see is how much data they can possibly get from re-entry on these, because you've got the Progress MS-21 is set to come back and burn up basically with all the trash on board in a couple of weeks. So that's going to be happening quickly, and hopefully they can get some data from that. And then you also have the uncrewed Soyuz that has the leak as well. So they're sending the new one up. You can send the old one back and see if it would survive, or see where there might be overheating on the spacecraft that might have been affected by this. So getting that back, I think, is going to be just as much an important learning experience as what they're doing now with the rescues and analyzing on orbit. And that, I think, will be a big factor in determining, is this really MMOD, or is there something more deep going on? And a lot of that we can get from data, but there's nothing like having the spacecraft back and going, okay, here's what we can see.
Yeah. And I just want to make sure that one part is clear there. There is no evidence that Soyuz, the crew vehicle, MS-22, which they do plan to bring back uncrewed. That's the whole reason for launching the next one uncrewed, right? But there is no indication that it would not survive atmospheric reentry itself intact. It's the temperature internal to the cabin and how high that rises, like 40s, 50s degrees centigrade, is not comfortable for a prolonged period of time. That's why it is still the emergency return vehicle for the two Russians who are on the station, whereas the US astronaut has transferred his emergency return seat to the Dragon.
And if I recall, the other issue is concerning of some of the internal computers and other items that are meant to be cool during that time, overheating potentially as well.
So I want to touch on this. So we're getting some questions about what the current plans are, how those plans are evolving as different vehicles get to the station with this one Soyuz kind of sort of out of commission. First of all, the nominal plan right now, as I understand it, and Chris, I know you went into this, so correct me if I get any of this wrong. So the American astronaut, Franco Rubio, that flew up on that Soyuz that now has a leak, has moved his seat liner thing into the Dragon that's currently the Crew 5 Dragon, which I don't remember which one that is. Is it Endurance? No, it's the new one. Hold on. SpaceX Crew 5.
Are we talking about the Dragon that's currently at the station? I believe it's Endurance.
Yeah. It is Endurance. I second guess myself. My fault. But yes, Endurance. So Franco Rubio has moved his seat liner to Endurance, correct?
Yes. Yeah. So his seat liner is on the Endurance.
So basically, hypothetically, something goes wrong on the ISS that needs to be evacuated. But there's nothing that's preventing anyone from reaching their designated, you know, return vehicles. Mm-hmm. Five crew members would actually get in Endurance, and then the two cosmonauts would get in Soyuz MS-23, which has the leak, which would likely cause some heating issues, but not ones that they would... Basically, Roscosmos said, we don't think it's like a safety threat. It might be uncomfortable, right? Am I characterizing that correctly?
Yes. Yeah. This is where the space agencies seemed to disagree, hence why Rubio's seat liner is on the Dragon right now. Because, yeah, Roscosmos basically said, we think it's fine. NASA looked at it and went, we're not necessarily comfortable enough with that. So we're going to switch him over here. It is also entirely possible, for completeness of the story, that Russia opted to not put their seat liners in Dragon purely for the political viewpoint that would be to have to rely on an American craft to bring their stricken spacecraft home. Right. It is entirely possible that was part of the reasoning and why the two countries split.
Yeah, and to that end, remember, Crew Dragon was originally designed for 7 astronauts, and while it nominally only carries 4, they have these contingencies where you can actually carry more than 4 people in Dragon in an emergency situation. So this is actually coming to fruition, not in the sense of they have activated those plans, but they are making them the current contingencies.
And Starliner has that 7 same person emergency contingency as well. Yep.
Exactly. And so, all right, so let's say they get to the launch of Soyuz MS-23, which will launch uncrewed, and it's basically replacing the MS-22 vehicle, and nothing happens. Franco Rubio moves his C-liner back to MS-22 at that point, correct? And they both just have their own assigned vehicles now again, right?
To MS-23. They get moved to 23,
sorry.
Yes.
To the new one, yes.
Yes.
Beforehand, there will also be American crew rotation, where a new Crew Dragon is going to come up, Crew 6, and Crew 5 is going to go back down. Just imagine that the sea liners move to Crew 6. But then also MS-22, then the stricken Soyuz vehicle. Mm-hmm. What are the deorbit plans for that? Are they going to attempt an intact reentry for that descent module, or have they not really specified?
That is a good question. I do not I'm catching up really, really quick on this. I believe their plan is that, okay, so the undocking and the return, they really haven't said. So I would almost imagine that they'd try to figure out a way to bring this thing back, because there's probably some cargo that they could justify wanting to bring back themselves. Yeah. On this, and that would be a good way to maximize your potential for the situation that you're in right now. That said, a destructive reentry over the Pacific is also entirely possible if they decide that they do not want to risk bringing it down over land. But the fact that they're committing their 2 astronauts to be the emergency landing
right
on it makes me think they're going to try to get it back and prove, look, we did it. It came back just fine. You know, I think there's some element to that as well.
And I mean, they even took Soyuz MS-23, the one that's launching uncrewed to replace MS-22, is even launching with some cargo. Roscosmos is basically taking advantage of that as almost an extra progress mission with just a little bit of cargo on board. So using MS-22 on the way back for a similar purpose would make sense. They also have that discussion of... do they try to destructive reentry or whatever? And MS-22, they added problem. We've talked about this with Starship. If you try to destructively reenter a vehicle that is designed to survive reentry, obviously you don't point the heat shield the right way and all this stuff. But some vehicles are, especially Soyuz capsules, are naturally stable in the safe orientation. So it might be difficult to actually destroy MS-22 on the way down. So how do you deal with that?
Yes, you actually look back to two very, very scary occurrences in October of 2007 and April of 2008, when the Soyuz crew vehicles were bringing three people back. Both of them were bringing three people back from the International Space Station. And when they blew the pyrotechnics to separate the three stages, cabling and physical connections between the propulsion module and the descent module did not sever on both of them back to back. And in that case, the capsule cannot right itself in the atmosphere and actually plunges in hatch first into the atmosphere. And they came terrifyingly close on those two to having potential burn throughs, significant charring on those particular parts of the vehicle. So basically, the way they would effect a destructive Soyuz reentry is they would target it over the ocean so that anything that does survive falls harmlessly, but they would not separate the three stages from each other so that there is no thermal protection system over the vehicle to actually protect it.
Right.
But I do want to make one point clear here. Bringing Soyuz MS-22 back does not get you the part that malfunctioned back. Yes. It is on the orbital module, which does destroy itself under nominal reentry
conditions. Or the service module, isn't it? Is it the cooled stuff on the service? The end with the solar arrays and the...
Well, the end with the service, is on the service module, but one's on... I thought I read that one of the coolant loops was on the orbital module as well. I might be confusing Soyuz in progress, but I am... But either way, you don't get the part that malfunctioned back on either of these. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And again, also of note in terms of crew and things with Dragon, I mean, right now there was a cosmonaut that flew on the most recent Crew 5 mission, and another is scheduled to launch on Crew 6 later this month.
Yes, true. Let me see. All right. So we got some questions coming in on this too, and then we're going to get into some Starship discussion as well. We just talked about the Frank Rubio plan. His current contingency is come back with Crew 5 on that Dragon. However, a nominal plan is that he'll come back on the Soyuz MS-23 vehicle that's about to be launched on crewed. And
they
talked about
basically get to stay a year now.
And it became a year-long mission as well for the two cosmonauts as well that he flew up with. So one more, and this answers from the purely technical perspective. Are the Russian vehicles and segment of the ISS necessary for continued ISS operations? We've talked about this a couple times in the recent years, but let's, from the purely technical perspective, Chris.
The answer is yes. As the station is currently configured, they absolutely are. Zvezda and Zarya both contain major components for the station's critical command and control systems, as well as the life support systems for the International Space Station. In fact, most of the time, there's sort of this balancing act that goes on between who has control of the ISS, but most of the time it is the Russian segment that is largely controlling the orientation of the ISS. And we have gyroscopes on the US side that help and aid with that when we need to really maintain specific orientations. And if you look at some of the docking cues, you can see how the docking cues will talk back and forth as to the handoff. But the Russian station, part of the station right now, is 100% necessary for the ISS. And here's the even more complicating factor. The US SEG side, NASA, actually owns Zarya.
Right.
So that whole we'll take our side of the station and leave threat from Russia a couple years ago, legally nebulous considering we own one of them. So yes.
Yeah. Also, some other questions that have come in here, some Super Chat questions. So thank you for the support. Musical Wolves asking, is there any chance that these leaks were caused by the missile test that Russia conducted a year or two ago? So this ties in with, was it a micrometeorite or was it orbital debris? And it's impossible to know for sure, unless you were somehow tracking it, in which case you would have avoided it. The rationale for the first strike being micrometeorite was because of the direction it came from, and the probability just came out to it is much more likely that it was a micrometeorite because it came from the wrong direction for it to be orbital debris. But that doesn't rule it out 100%. It's just a matter of probability. It is worthwhile to mention that anti-satellite tests do create a more hazardous environment in low Earth orbit. Both Russia and China have done them relatively recently. India did one relatively recently as well. So worth adding to the discussion, but there's no evidence to support the correlation between the two as of right now. is perhaps the most succinct way to answer that question. And then another question from Musical Wolves. Again, thank you for the support. Can the hatch between those two vehicles be closed? Oops, I accidentally clicked through. The question was, can the hatch between those vehicles be closed to make sure that the ISS doesn't have to account for a loss of cooling, basically? And the answer is, that's actually one of the first things you do. You seal off the hatch between the vehicle that has had some pressure loss event and the rest of the station. So if anything goes wrong, it's isolated. They can continue to monitor the temperatures, and if they need to, you know, get in and out of that progress vehicle in the meantime, as long as they'll monitor the temperatures and as long as there's nothing too problematic, they can open and close that hatch as needed. And they'll just continue monitoring that as they need to. But yes, they can do that.
And NASA also, for clarity, right, classified this as a depressurization of the coolant system. There was no depressurization. There was no like hull breach.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
For it. It was not a depress in the actual modules themselves.
There you go.
In fact, I don't believe they actually closed the hatches between Progress and the ISS once they saw it, because there was no atmospheric change.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you for that, Chris.
Yeah, the only time I could recall them doing it is when they did find that leak that they eventually had to find and patch on the ISS. Yes. And then, of course, the major incident with Mir a while back with the docking gone wrong.
The recent one, the MS-09, where there was a hole drilled eventually. I think I remember that it happened in like the middle of the night, and it was such a slow week that they didn't even wake up the crew. They're just like, all right, when they wake up, we'll tell them that, hey, your plans have changed for the next day. But like closing the hatch and stuff was mostly a troubleshooting thing. Like, we have to find where the leak is. So if we close this hatch, we'll see which side leaks, basically.
Which, when they were trying to track down the leak on the ISS, completely different from the Soyuz's a year and a half ago, that is exactly what they did. They closed all at the one weekend. They literally closed all the hatches between all the modules and watched to see which one leaked. And that's what told them it was in Zvezda.
Yeah, there you go. So that, I think, wraps up our Russian discussion. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking more about this as new results from the investigation and everything comes out. And I want to give a big thank you to everyone who is sending support during the stream with memberships and super chats, trying to answer those questions as well. So thank you also so much for that. If you are looking for a new way to support the NASA Spaceflight team, I can highly recommend the NASAspaceflight.com shop, which has some new merch, including merch commemorating the recent static fire of Booster 7 down in Starbase, which we're going to get to here in a little bit. So there is new 33-engine static fire merch on the shop available for a limited time. In addition to some other cool new merch, we've got the Falcon 9 launch entry and landing sequence. If you want to show off your Falcon 9 landing engine configuration knowledge, that's a great way to send support. And we're always adding new things in the form of metal prints or new designs as new spaceflight news events comes out and you want to show that you are in the loop on the latest in spaceflight. All of these merch items and things go towards improving our coverage, upgrading equipment, and allowing us to continue providing the best coverage that we can. There's a cool metal print. I believe that photo is from Nick and Sweeney for the NASA spaceflight team of the recent static fire. So there's some new wall art if that's something you're into. But just a big thank you to anyone who sends support that way. We greatly appreciate it. Let's go ahead and move on to our last big story of the week, which takes us down to Starbase, Texas. We have recently had a big 31-engine static fire test of Booster 7. I believe we're going to have a replay of that video, and I'm even told that we're going to have to shut up for it because we want to listen into the audio of Booster 7 firing up. So we'll get into that in just a second here. But 31 of the 33 engines on Booster 7 fired up, and that was basically planned ahead of time. It was originally going to be a 33-engine static fire test. The teams removed one engine ahead of time because they had identified some, you know, issue with that engine and removed it from the test. And then Elon said that a second engine was removed automatically during the countdown or during the ignition sequence. But let's listen in and watch a replay of this 31 engine static fire on Booster 7. That is the most Raptor engines that have been fired simultaneously on a Super Heavy booster to date. And we got a lot of cool camera views of it. This is, of course, also a huge step towards flight readiness for this booster. Elon later tweeted that this test was conducted at about 50% throttle on those 31 engines, then the launch attempt would be at about 90% throttle, just a little bit of safety margin for that first flight. I'm now slightly looking over. Yeah, with like the fire coming up over the berm near the tank farm and stuff.
Super the berm cool. Showing what it's there for. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yep. And that angle I liked because the ship on top. Like, if you imagine the ship on top, you can imagine what liftoff might look like, just like a little bit. It's not as crazy as I thought it might be. Like, the dust cloud is huge, but I can kind of imagine it getting off and still remaining visible at least. I love the reaction on that audio there too.
And that's the dust cloud at 50% as well.
Right, yeah.
And I think this thing is lifting off about 3 seconds after engine start.
Yeah, I think that's more hold down firing time than we would expect for the launch attempt. Like, the checkout time is less than that.
I still get giddy looking at that again. It brings me right back to the day of watching it. It's still exciting.
All those replays with audio is available on the NASA Spaceflight channel, as always, for those who want to go back and enjoy. But the significance of this test is huge, and I'm going to tie in our next question from chat, because the question everyone's asking now, when orbit? Thank you for the support there, Octavian. But so, this was like the last big technical milestone ahead of launch readiness, right? I mean, they've gone through wet dress rehearsals, they've gone through testing of the ship individually, and they've hit 31 of these engines. And it sounds like, based on the language that Elon was using on Twitter to describe this test, that there's no real plans that they're going to repeat this test with two more extra engines or whatever, that they can work all of that into the pre-flight checks that go into actual launch readiness. And, you know, that couple seconds of the engines firing while held down on the launch mount will be enough for them to verify that they can send this thing to orbit or to near orbit, whatever they're going to target for that flight. Hopefully we get some details. But is this it? Is launch readiness the next thing to go? Sawyer, what's next?
That's what it appears to be. At this point, again, based off of what's been said, it sounds like the plan is to push ahead and go for orbit next. So they'll have to still obviously get ship 24 finished and ready, stack that back on top, and then the final preparations for the liftoff itself. But as of right now, that's the main goals that they needed to get through, ending with this major, almost all engine static fire is the last one. And as Elon put, even if on the actual orbital launch attempt, you only had 31 engines fire, it's still enough to get to orbit.
Yes. And of course, we should differentiate that between, you know, decisions made pre-launch and what happens in flight. You don't design engine out capability in a rocket so that you can launch with less than all of your engines firing. The point is to protect yourself against in-flight shutdowns of engines for off nominal reasons. So on a launch day, SpaceX would not have gone, all right, before the test, they knew one. We know one of our engines isn't working, but we've got engine out capability, so we'll launch anyway. That's not how it works. You fix that engine, and then you launch with all 33 operational. During that pre-launch like startup sequence, if one aborts itself, that would also almost certainly be a launch abort criteria, where you would shut down and stand down from that launch attempt until you could fix it. Engine out capability protects you on once you've lifted off with all 33 engines running. If something happens after that, you could still reach orbit if an engine or two shuts down here or there. Mm-hmm. So a worthwhile delineation to be made there.
In fact, we saw it right a couple of years ago on a Falcon 9 where it lost an engine. I mean, almost at like T0. I mean, it was right as it was coming off the launch pad. Flight still succeeded.
Yeah, Falcon 9 has demonstrated engine out capability a couple times, including the one you touched on earlier, where the secondary payload wasn't deployed. It's because the upper stage had to compensate for an early engine one loss, or stage one engine on stage one loss. So yeah, that's demonstrated a couple times in Falcon 9, and Super Heavy has that kind of similar capability built into it. Let me see other things, but we're going to dive into some questions, other news points to hit on here. So they've also received some deluge equipment down at Starbase. This is something that we're going to keep an eye on. What is the is that going to be installed before first flight, or is that something that's going to happen later? There we go. We're getting interrupted. I don't know. Thank you, Michael. You had the audio from the replay, but there's the tanks getting rolled in. That's the tanks that they've actually installed already.
Yep.
This is not, they haven't installed like the pipes and the, like what you'd call like rain birds that actually take that water and put it out to the launch pad yet. But the tanks that came on the barge from Kennedy Space Center and are believed to be part of this deluge system have been installed. So they're working on it. But I'm going to ask the hypothetical. So, Chris, is that something that we're going to expect to see installed before the first flight? Or is this something that they could say, we'll send the first mission, and then when we're preparing for a second flight while working any other things they want to fix on the vehicle and stuff like that, we will also improve the launch site by adding deluge capability? Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I kind of think we'd see slightly more movement if they were actually going to be there for the first orbital flight. So I think my hedge on this one is going to be that it's going to come down to sequencing. I don't think they need it for the first flight, but I think if it's one of those things where they could have it, it might be beneficial, but I don't necessarily see indications that you have to have it for the liftoff, especially following this past Thursday.
So what are you thinking about deluge and when's that going to come in?
I think that's going to be after the first orbital flight for sure. I mean, at this point, they, even though, again, it was only 50%, not 90, they proved that the system with the FireX that they have for now will work. And again, there's a very strong chance that the pad will end up dealing some significant damage, whether it be from the 90% throttle or, we hope not, but the potential for an anomaly or RUD of some kind. I don't think it would make sense to bring all that equipment out and get it in there now, as opposed to waiting to see exactly what happens after that first orbital flight, what your stage zero looks like, and then analyze, okay, here's where we would need the rainbirds, here's where we would need the deluge system the most, and go from there.
Michael, you're not as slick as you think you are. I saw what you did, and I'm not going to pretend that I didn't. We'll see if chat picked up on that. But the next bit here, the other thing that we're keeping on, and we got a bunch of questions about this, and we're totally going to dive in. Ship 26 made an appearance, and it looks weird, like really weird. It's got no heat shield. It's got no fins. It doesn't have a payload bay, but it's out at the launch site now, along with Ship 25, both at the suborbital launch pads for presumably some testing before their own launch campaigns. So, guys, what do we think that ship could even do? It can't carry a payload, at least not one that will be deployed. Can't come back and re-enter. What could that be up to? There's the imagery of it next to Ship 25. Chris, what are we thinking?
It is either a test article to help the booster test a landing catch on the towers would be my, I don't think that's what it really is. Looks mighty like an unpainted human landing system variant to me. My honest guess on this one would be this is testing some of the systems that are unique to the human landing system variant of Starship for NASA's Artemis program.
It could be. It could even be simply like an aerodynamics test of this is what HLS would more or less be aerodynamically during flight. I do notice that I don't see any landing legs or any caveats for landing legs near the bottom, which HLS will need. No catch towers on the moon. But again, that could be a relatively minor factor. I think the other item that we've seen as a potential explanation is some sort of tanker propellant depot test, right? I mean, that would also be.
That's what I was thinking.
A distinction to be made there, though, because the tankers, the ones that are going to go refuel a depot that's already in orbit, should be reusable, right? Those are going to have to go up and back carrying fuel on a multiple trips and things, right?
This might be the depot itself.
So, exactly. The depot is, think of it almost as a mini space station that just is a giant fuel tank that sits in Earth orbit for however many years, could be reused over and over again. We have seen some graphics via like HLS reports and Artemis reports that suggest that the depot might be stretched. So the one like caveat here is like, well, that looks to be the same height as all the other vehicles. But if it's just a prototype, doesn't necessarily need to be the full size. Also, SpaceX could have evolved the design and said, actually, no, it could be the same size as all the other variants. So it's hard to know for sure. But I think I'm leaning towards the propellant depot thing, which ties in with HLS and maybe an HLS variant will also come, or maybe this is going to dock with a propellant depot kind of prototype and develop that capability in some way. Because we've been saying, once Starship does reach orbit successfully, what are the first missions going to be? And there are two things: Starlink deployment and support of HLS development, whether that's in orbit refilling demonstrations with this kind of vehicle or something like that, or the lander itself design getting tested and checked out. Those are the things I'd expect to see in the near term. So we're going to be keeping an eye on those two vehicles and what test campaigns they undergo. However, Ship 24, as far as we know, is still the near-term focus for the first orbital flight, right? That's still undergoing pre-flight checks?
Indeed it is, and that is the plan. 24 and 7 will be the ones to do it at present.
All right, so we're going to keep an eye on that as well, and Ship 24 rolling back to the launch site would definitely be a big milestone. In addition to maybe checking out those engines that might need to be swapped or something like that on Booster 7. But the next big milestone has got to be stacking for launch. So anyway, Michael. Yeah. I'm not pointing that out. Chat has to see it for itself. I'm going to bring in some questions here. Not directly related to Starship, but Nate asking if there are any Falcon Heavy launches slated for this year. The answer is yes. Falcon Heavy missions edition. The next one, I believe, should be the Viasat 3 mission on a Falcon Heavy. So, yes, there are Falcon Heavy missions coming as well. Thank you for that question. Morton, thank you for your Topcom membership. Hope you enjoy. And then Morton also gifted a Red Team membership. So, Morton, thank you for that amount of support there. Musical Wolves has a good question. Even at 50% throttle, was that still more thrust than SLS's liftoff? Chris, SpaceX steal that record yet? I don't think so.
Not according to their tweet. According to their tweet, they maxed out. If they would have had the other engines, they probably would have eked that out from the liftoff one. But no, they ended at 7.9 million pounds of thrust. SLS is 8 at liftoff. So very, very close. But SLS still holds the title.
There we go. Another question here from Mizka Wolves. Launching 24 and 7, does that mean it could launch at any hour? Bad joke, Musical Wolves. Bad joke. Appreciate the support there. I'm going to bring some more questions here.
I will say, Raymond, at least is this booster combo, not the previous combo.
That's true. That's true. The previous combo also had some memes with it. Raymond says, if Ship 26 really is a fuel depot, would it have Raptor C levels as well as Raptor vacuums? Or would the engine configs be different? Also, someone else in chat asking, shouldn't it have RCS thrusters and things like that? Have we seen anything to that end on Ship 26? What do we know that vehicle has?
Well, I'm going to take the first part of that with the Raptors and the sea levels and the RVACs. There's nothing that we know of that would differentiate how they are going to put the engines in the actual ships, right? The center cluster of sea level ones are the ones that gimbal to provide that authority control during the climb uphill. But you need the vacuum engines for their efficiency and their optimization in that regard. So I would personally expect to see the same mix of 3-3 in the depots, because nothing about their ascent profile really changes based on the base design of the ship.
Yeah. In terms of what it has, it's interesting in that we pointed out without the fins, without the payloads. Alex also pointing out that Ship 26 doesn't even have any docking systems either, as of now, at least. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot that it doesn't have more so than what it does have right now.
Yeah. Now, and a couple points to that, right? It might not be done. There might be more work that it needs to have added. But the fact that it doesn't have RCS, which is a great question to this, not necessarily, because we have seen SpaceX want to use vents, like the liquid oxygen vents and everything, to be the RCS in that regard. So you wouldn't need RCS to test for the propellant depot, because it would still utilize that slight release of pressure to impart the rotation onto the vehicle and get it there. You can also use gyroscopes to keep things in various positions. You could have these little thruster quads that you would add to the depot variant, all sorts of different things there. So not seeing them isn't necessarily it can't be the propellant depot, because they're already sort of trying to get away from RCS to a degree.
Right, like dedicated RCS. You make the vents multi-purpose, basically. And to that point, I want to stress that, because so little is known about what this vehicle's role actually is, It could also be simply there are some small internal systems that we can't see from the outside that test some valve or some system that will be used on the fully operational propellant depot later, but we have no idea until SpaceX actually says something about it because we can't see it from the outside. That's also completely possible. So we're going to keep an eye on it. We'll see what testing it undergoes. We'll see what the flight plans for it are. And we'll
it's
keep
also
you
possible
all updated,
it's but... just a ground test vehicle.
Also that, yeah.
Yeah.
Could be a manufacturing pathfinder for certain things. I mean, there are a lot of different explanations, and in the absence of official information, that's what we have. I do have a quick question that I have not thought about yet, and is fascinating. Nick wants to know, when the depot need long-duration power management? If you think of the concept of operations for on-orbit refilling, if you launch the depot, that's the storage vehicle for propellant, and then you launch a bunch of tankers up and back, the HLS lander eventually docks to it, or whatever vehicle you're refilling, takes all that propellant and then goes off to its mission destination. Assuming you want to make that depot reusable, even if it's not being reused across multiple missions, it's going to have to loiter on orbit for a while. Wouldn't a depot need like solar panels or some sort of power generation system? And we haven't seen that on like the graphics that we've seen yet.
Yes, we have. We have. We have. It's on
Am
the
crazy?
Lunar variant. You have to go to the lunar variant, and the ones that SpaceX and NASA have released from that, the solar panels are the design of where the solar panels are going to go as they band around the vehicle are on there.
Okay, interesting.
Yes.
What about the potential for something like a fuel cell, considering you already have a fuel depot?
SpaceX would honestly opt for solar arrays and batteries. Far, far simpler, because all you're really trying to do on the power mitigation element of that is protect for your nighttime passes in orbital in orbital darkness. Like, and to that, I just point to any satellite in LEO, including the ISS, for how we do that. It is, you really have to look for them, but the solar panel placements are on that lunar variant. They are.
Okay. And the, I mean, even the, what's the word I'm looking for? Oh, yeah, the fuel cell. Hydrogen fuel cells are like the most common ones. The shuttle had them. Several other vehicles have had them. But a methane? I don't even know if I've heard of a methane fuel cell. Like, is that a thing? I'm sure it's technically possible. I just don't know if I've seen it been in use.
Never seen one in use, and not that I know of. I've the hydrogen ones are by far exactly what you were saying there, Thomas. And I think there, if there's one propellant SpaceX has absolutely no desire to use, it is hydrogen, considering skipped it big time.
Fun fact, the original Raptor engine was a Hydrolox engine, but it became a methane engine. This is going to be an upper stage upgrade for the Falcon fleet. Anyway, moving on to our next question here. Matt says, is the Starship orbital flight more risky than Falcon Heavy's first flight? I recall Elon saying there was a low chance of success on Falcon Heavy. Sawyer, you get to go first. What do you think?
Ooh, that, again, another really good question. Is it more risky? I think yes, because with Falcon Heavy, at least you had the heritage of knowing how Falcon 9 flew. So you've got something you can at least work off of there. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's very dangerous in that you risked destroying a historic launch pad at 39A, but you're talking about using brand new fuels with methane here that they haven't necessarily worked with before, brand new engines with the Raptor 2s that they're not used to using in their current launch cadence. So my guess is yes, just because there's so many new elements, and while they are borrowing some from Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy, it's essentially a brand new rocket, new systems, new everything. So I see this as a lot more risky.
Chris, what do you think?
Interesting. I agree with everything you said. My answer is no, because Falcon Heavy risked 39A and crew flights. So to me, no, even if you fail on this one and Boca infrastructure is damaged, you have not lost the critical launch pad infrastructure that you absolutely needed to continue.
Yeah, I think I agree with you there, Chris. I think the delineation between it's less risky because there's less at stake. The probability of launch failure might be higher, though.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. So there you go. Let's see. Oh, Chet's telling me that methane fuel cells are totally a thing. Okay, Chet, thanks for letting me know. appreciate that. Let's see. Also, I am getting word that perhaps the merch pie thing might not have been working because Michael's letting me know that Roberts ordered 3 metal prints and said some fantastic photos. Can't wait for the Starship launch. So, Roberts, thank you for your support. We're getting those in. I'm going to thank all of you, even if it's not showing on screen. My apologies on that. Brandon ordered the 33 Static Fire mug. Yes, a larger coffee mug. Love y'all's hard work and live streams. Appreciate the support there, Brandon, as well. Call that the Propellant Depot variant of the mug. I don't know. Maybe that's a bad joke.
If it made me laugh, it's a bad joke.
Yeah, exactly. That's. let me see. What other questions we got here? Let's see. Richie asking, do we think that we could see Starship only hops at Boca Chica again, for example, to test landing legs for the moon? We expect any hop test in the future? What do you think?
I mean, I would never rule it out if they needed to test landing leg stuff for the lunar program and they actually wanted to test it in flight, you could do it. However, I hedge here because the only thing you'd really need to test would be the actuators, right? Like your Raptor engines aren't firing when you're landing on the moon per the current plan. The upper gas thrusters are what are firing to bring you down. So it's a good question. I think there might be slightly more to that for Mars than there is for the moon, because at least sure. Mars has an atmosphere and your Raptors have to be firing for the landing on Mars, whereas the moon is an atmosphereless void basically,
yeah.
With 1/6 gravity, so you don't even need the Raptors. In fact, if you use the Raptors, you'd blast a lot of the regolith directly into lunar orbit or away from lunar orbit. So yeah,
if it's gonna happen anywhere, it would be at Boca, though. That's basically, they flat out said that's going to be their testing ground, with eventually transitioning all the major launches to the Cape.
Yeah, there we go, thank you for that. Let's see, what other questions do we have here? Try to take one more Starship question. SpaceX Spacecraft asking, will the chopstick arms be cladded? Well, in that animation we just saw, the chopstick arms and the launch tower do look a little bit different than they do in real life right now. The context I would add to this, here at 39A Florida, the former shuttle fixed server structure, I think SpaceX just calls it the crew access tower now, definitely got cladded, but after Falcon 9 had already been flying from that pad, it's not like a near-term requirement. On these videos, you can see they've started adding cladding to the tower near the bottom. They started, but it's not like a requirement for first flight. It more future-proofs the structure and gives it more long-term longevity and reduces maintenance you need and stuff like that. But it's not like a structural component that's needed before they fly or anything like that. Will the arms be included in that? Potentially. The renders seem to indicate that it might be. And we'll expect to see that over at the 39A Starship Tower as well. But no real clarity as to when in the sequence they'll need to get that work done, or if that'll just be a longer term thing. All right. We're getting near the end of the show. And we got a couple more questions that circle back to the Russian discussion. So I want to hit these two really quick as well. AstroZona says, when Axiom takes over operations on the station, the Axiom is planning to expand the ISS and have their own segment of the vehicle. Will Russians on the International Space Station still be required? While it's docked to the rest of the ISS, yes, still, right?
Yes. Yeah. Russians are right now kind of required. They can leave if they want to. But one of the things the Axiom modules would allow for is if they really, 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 really did not want us to use them, if they wanted to take some of them away, the ISS really isn't meant to be taken apart. But if they really wanted to, the Axiom modules could provide the additional power, the additional life support systems, the additional control authority to a degree to offset that. However, I will say, after the big first boasting, like, ha 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 ha, we're going to leave from Russia, we have really seen a massive pullback on that right. PR front. If I were a betting man, they'll be with us to the end of the ISS.
Right. I think I agree with you there.
Yeah. But those are the Axiom modules. Yeah.
Yeah. And once Axiom is free flying, because the long term plan is once they expand the ISS, like you see here, Axiom is intended, if the ISS gets retired, Axiom can separate and free fly and become its own space station, commercially owned and operated. NASA would fully plan on utilizing that capability as a commercial sense rather than owning and operating their own segment of the station. And in that situation, it's kind of up to Axiom whether they also open that up to additional international partners, including Russia, China, even the ESA and stuff, or ESA. I'm going to keep getting yelled at. I'm supposed to call it ESA. For some reason, I keep saying the ESA, ESA, JAXA, places like that.
And there seems to be a huge partnership between Axiom and the United Arab Emirates' space program,
yes,
as well.
Too.
So yeah. I mean, if there's one thing the last 2 years have sort of taught us, it's pay a lot of attention to the UAE. They are becoming a massive player in this. In fact, so much so that my joke about a new partner for the Gateway ended up actually being them, and I had just jokingly guessed them. Definitely pay attention to the UAE here and Axiom.
Yeah, absolutely. And one more Russian question here. Delta IV Heavy wants to know, can Russian pressure suits plug into Crew Dragon ports? So in an emergency, can cosmonauts hitch a ride on Dragon to come home, even though they're wearing the different spacesuits? The spacesuits are different.
Yeah, so I'm going to stop completely short of saying they plug in perfectly. But yes, the Sokol suits are in some ways for emergencies somewhat compatible. It is not like the regular folks in Dragon who have the nice seats, but there is compatibility that was built into the systems to accommodate that. Yes.
Keep in mind that Franco Rubio is up there with a Soyuz suit, a Sokol suit, not right. a Crew Dragon suit. But the kid's contingency is still to come back on Crew Dragon. So there's enough compatibility that they can come home. Yes. Is short of saying that it's not exactly plug and play.
Right.
By the way, go back really quick, just mentioning UAE while we're talking about don't sleep on them. Don't forget, they actually have a crew member going up on Crew 6 on that Dragon coming up later this month, too.
And the reason I say them with Axiom is Axiom brokered that deal.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So there we go. Also want to thank Byron, who was another shop order. And again, sorry, the messages on screen aren't coming up. We'll get that fixed. But says great coverage and bought the Raptor 33 static fire hoodie and an ignition metal print. Good choices there, Byron. And thank you so much for the support. Also got Spambot. Is there a user named Spambot that gifted 5 Red Team memberships? Fantastic. Appreciate the support there. And Musical Wolf is asking if we can make a thermos in the shape of Starship. I'll let the store team work on that, but appreciate the support as always. I think that brings us to the end of the show this week. So thank you to Sawyer and Chris for joining me on today's show and everyone for tuning in. I do have one quick chat message from Grayson who wants to ask, could we do a quick recap on what we talked about today? Well, today's show is also available in podcast form, and there's a link in the description below to the NSF Live podcast. We're also publishing some of our feature videos and stuff like that as podcast form, so you can follow those wherever you get your podcasts if you want to take in your space news in another outlet. And also, we're always working at experimenting with some other sort of podcast forums and things like that. So if you are interested in that kind of content, check us out over on your podcast platforms as well. So I think that does it for today's show. I want to thank all of the memberships as well. If you are a launch director or a flight engineer, you get your above and beyond perk as your name shown at the end of NSF Live. And we do want to thank everyone who goes above and beyond with their support from the NASA Spaceflight team there. But I think that does it for our show. First and foremost, Chris Gebhardt, Assistant Managing Editor of NASA Spaceflight. Thank you so much for joining us this week.
My absolute pleasure. And the one question that was in there on the third one that I did see, yes, it is a former Cardassian space station, Team Bajor.
There we go. And also Sawyer Rosenstein, writer and editor and commentator, and you do a lot of stuff around here. Sawyer, thank you so
I don't know what just happened there all of a sudden, but thank you, everybody. I swear that wasn't a picture of me.
I don't know what picture you were talking about. I didn't see anything.
But no, I appreciate everyone joining and you guys for a great conversation. As always, it's always fun to talk space with people who love it, and just makes it so much fun every Sunday.
You know, last time Michael accidentally put two of me on screen. Now he's accidentally giving away the jokes that were throughout the show. That's funny. Michael, thank you so much for operating today's stream and the little
NORAD
Easter egg there.
Inbound.
And yeah, operating really. The F-22s apparently that are now part of the stream.
We greatly appreciate that. Not the only Raptors we talked about today, am I right?
And on that bombshell, I think that we're going to wrap up today's show. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Stay tuned for future spaceflight news coverage, both here on the YouTube channel and over on NASASpaceflight.com. My name is Thomas Burkhart, signing off for now. Thank you all so much for watching. We'll see you all next time.
Yikes. You bet.
Okay.
We don't need any more of these.